From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, near-death experiences. We'll have emerging artist bumper music for the first couple hours tonight. Full information at the coasttocoastam.com website on these incredible artists. Here's what's happening. A U.S. health authority has expanded the use of the leading COVID-19 vaccines. Researchers are investigating heart-related risks linked to the shots, and they're exploring several emerging theories, including one centered on the spike protein made in response to the vaccination. Researchers aren't certain why the messenger RNA vaccines, one from Pfizer, the other from Moderna, is likely causing the inflammation in the heart conditions in a small number of cases. A pill to treat COVID developed by the U.S. company Pfizer cuts the risk of hospitalization or death, they say, by 89% in vulnerable adults, according to clinical trial results. The drug is intended for use soon after symptoms develop in people at high risk of severe disease. A federal appeals court has suspended the Biden administration's new vaccine requirement for private companies, delivering a major blow for one of the White House's signature attempts to increase the number of vaccinations to corral the pandemic. This decision was issued by a panel of three judges appointed by Republican presidents in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The judges wrote that there was cause to believe that there are grave statutory and constitutional issues with the mandate. Staying the order, that's stopping the order, while the court assesses it in more depth. And Congress has passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, approving part of President Joe Biden's economic agenda. It will deliver $550 billion of new federal investments in America's infrastructure over 5 years, touching everything from bridges and roads to the nation's broadband, water, and energy systems. Catherine Austin Fitz is with us. Catherine, do you think this is good for America? Do we need this? And I don't think Catherine is with us. Well, she's not there, folks, but it is good for America, so we'll see what happens. Two teenagers were among the eight victims who died after a crowd surge Friday night during a tragedy with rapper Travis Scott's sold-out AstroWorld Music Festival in Houston. Of the 25 people who were taken to the hospital, 13 remained hospitalized. The 14-year-old child was also murdered and died in that horrible situation. President of the National Border Patrol, Brandon Judd, has asserted that the United States is now the biggest crisis we've ever seen as it pertains to border security, arguing it's because the Biden administration reversed all of former President Trump's immigration policies. Here's Charles R. Smith with his reaction. Charles, what do you think of this?
The Border Patrol and Mr. Judd's reaction is fairly logical and seems to fit completely with the logic of the border at the moment. When you lay it wide open, allow them to come in, and then not show up for hearings, we are and come across.
Well, they're coming like crazy, and they say that the Trump administration had a control over this. What do you think?
Yes, it did, actually, and that's because the policy was to hold them in the Mexican side and wait for their hearings. The basic idea there was, obviously, when you finally get your hearing, then you'll either come in or you won't. Well, when obviously they're not being let loose into the American public, the immigrants decided, well, it was much more prudent not to even bother coming. The Biden administration, of course, is going to face a new challenge with this gigantic flood that is currently a wave on its way of 40 to 60,000 immigrants marching across Mexico. Mexico is not happy with the Biden administration because they're also under a lot of pressure and suffering from the issues of illegal immigrants crossing through their territory to get here.
All right, Charles, thank you so much. The story we have in the news at coasttocoastam.com. Don't worry, but in December, a large asteroid approximately 330 meters long is headed for really close to planet Earth. We're going to keep our eyes on it. Dr. Stephen Skye will be doing a story on that tomorrow night in our news. Up next, the laws of human nature. We're going to talk about what drives people and what motivates them. Robert Green joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Robert Green with us, The Laws of Human Nature. Let me tell you about Robert, first of all. He's the author of New York Times best-selling books, The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, The 33 Strategies of War, The 50th Law and Mastery, and in addition, of course, The Laws of Human Nature, which we're going to talk about tonight. He's got a strong following within the business world and a deep following in Washington, D.C. His books are hailed by everyone from war historians to the biggest musicians in the industry. Green has attended UC Berkeley and the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where he received a degree in classical studies, lives in Los Angeles. Robert, welcome to the program. Looking forward to this tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, George. I'm in my pajamas and I'm ready to go.
Isn't that comfortable to be able to do that? And we're not Zooming you, so you don't have to worry about that.
That's right. If you were Zooming me, I'd be in a suit and tie, but here I can sit in my pajamas.
Your books are very varied. Tell me about the differences in all these books that you've written.
Well, they are different, but there's a common theme. So my first book, which is my biggest seller, The 48 Laws of Power, I try and show what really goes on in the world. You know, we have an image of CEOs and leaders and bosses. They like to project the fact that maybe they're like Mahatma Gandhi, or in fact, they're actually very Machiavellian. And I, prior to being a writer, had many, many different jobs in journalism, in Hollywood, and I worked in construction, I worked in a detective agency, and I had all kinds of bosses. And I saw that behind the scenes, people can be very manipulative, very deceptive, very Machiavellian. But nobody writes about this. It's almost like a taboo subject. All the self-help books out there pretend that, you know, people are basically angels at heart, and this kind of behavior is aberrant. Whereas my experience is it's not that way at all. So I looked at a lot of history, and I kind of devised these laws of power that I think powerful people use every day in offices. So that's my first book.
Are there similarities with some of these people who are very successful?
Yes, there's similarities. There are common themes. And what I did is I looked at history. So I looked at great kings and queens and presidents and political figures in every culture and every period of time. And I saw commonalities. So, for instance, one of the laws of power says, always say less than necessary. And the idea is that powerful people tend to talk less than others. They let others do all the talking so that they can reveal their weaknesses, that they can say something stupid. But powerful people like to try and create this kind of aura of kind of like a mystery around them. So the less they speak, the more powerful they appear. And in meetings, you know, if they only say a few sentences, everybody's hanging on their every word and wanting to interpret it. Whereas if they talk and talk and talk, it tends to signal kind of a weakness, like you can't control yourself, you can't control your tongue. And if you can't control what you say, how can you have any kind of self-control as a leader? So, you know, these are kind of timeless things that I have uncovered about people in power.
When you were writing The Laws of Human Nature, how did you discover these similarities and traits?
Well, through a lot of research for that particular book, that was my sixth book, I did a lot of research in neuroscience and on human behavior, on psychology, and on biology and how we are wired. And so I found certain common tendencies that we all have. Now, I happen to be someone, for good or for bad, who's sort of interested in the dark side of human nature. And so the laws that I uncover sort of deal with some aspects of us that we maybe don't like to admit, like our self-absorption. You know, we tend to think, we always point fingers and say, that person, they're a narcissist. That person, they're aggressive or full of envy or whatever. But we never like to admit this about ourselves. We want to think that we're somehow exempt from these laws of human nature, but we all share these negative qualities. And I want to throw a light on them and show you that it's embedded in who we are. It's very deep within us, and it's much better to confront our own aggressive impulses, our own tendencies towards envy, Every single human being who's ever lived has tendencies to feel envy. It's wired into our nature, and I go into depth in the book about why we are prone to feeling envy. So I want to make you think more deeply about who you are and come to terms with some of the realities that you tend to try and repress.
Robert, why do we have so many different human trait personalities? I mean, we've got aggressive people, we've got people who aren't, we have mean people, we have nice people. Why are they so different?
Well, that's probably something genetic. Everybody's wired differently. Everybody has a unique set of DNA, and obviously your early years play a very large role in it. And one of the main things I talk about in all of my books is your ability as a social animal to see each person that you deal with as an individual. So you tend to project your own emotions, your own ideas, your own desires and wishes on the people you encounter. And you're not really seeing them as they are, seeing their individual nature, what makes them tick. So a lot of my books are focusing on how you can develop high-level antennae for seeing what makes every single person different, what motivates their behavior. So, but why there's so many different people, I think that's kind of something that's a healthy thing. And, you know, in cultures where there isn't such diversity, like in totalitarian regimes or in communist regimes, you notice that the culture is very stultified and very dead. So I think the fact that we are very different, at least here in the United States, is actually a very healthy thing.
When you've looked at some of the traits of people, did you look at the traits of our past presidents as well? Because they were all different.
Yes. I mean, I didn't go into people like Millard Fillmore and you know, and Hayes, Rutherford
right.
Hayes, and some of the more obscure presidents. But the ones like Lincoln, I'm fascinated with Abraham Lincoln. I've written about him extensively in all of my books. I've read dozens of biographies of him. I think he's by far the most fascinating president we ever had, a very strange man in so many ways, not the kind of cartoon image of Lincoln that we have got as children. And I studied in depth people like Eisenhower and FDR and Kennedy, more of the, and particularly Lyndon Baines Johnson with the great Robert Caro books. There's some very fascinating personalities, but I have to say my favorite is Abraham Lincoln.
Well, how would you categorize him with his traits?
Well, he was very complex, and that's something we don't understand. So he had two sides to himself. He almost, you know, had this kind of schizophrenia in a way. On the one hand, he was an extremely sensitive person. He had a kind of a soft side. He loved poetry, and he had some early deaths in his life, and he could be very morbid and had a very kind of depressive side. On the other hand, he was like this kind of rugged individual who, as a young man, loved boxing and loved, you know, beating up people and all sorts of things like that. And he often thought of himself, why do I have these two kind of warring sides in me? I can't seem to reconcile them. This was early on in his career. And then the fascinating thing to see about Abraham Lincoln is as he got older, he found a way to kind of bring together these two very disparate sides of his personality. So as a president, he could be very, very firm, and that was what made him such a great president. So he determined very early on the strategy for defeating the South, and his idea was he wasn't going to crush the South. He wanted to come out where there would be a unified country, but he would be very firm. He wouldn't let anybody push him around. He knew exactly how to prosecute this war, and he had all these generals who wouldn't listen to him, but he was very firm. But on the other hand, he could be very soft, and he hated, you know, the loss of lives in so many of the battles. And he had a very empathetic side that I think made people identify with him. And so that complexity of Abraham Lincoln, I think, makes him very human and very warm and very interesting. He was, I think, the greatest president we ever had.
And you believe empathy is important, don't you?
I do. And it's a strange quality. So a lot of my books are about nonverbal communication. So the weird thing about human beings is we are essentially animals. And a lot of our behavior was developed before the invention of language. And so people have estimated that 95% of our communication between us is nonverbal. It's in the tone of our voice, it's in our body language, it's in expressions in our face. And we have this amazing ability to pick up the signals from other people. So we can't read the minds of people, I don't believe, unless you believe in telepathy. But we can read the moods and emotions of other people. We're wired for that. It's something that goes back hundreds of thousands of years when our survival depended on operating in a group. So we have this insane sensitivity towards other people. We can pick up their moods, their emotions, how they're feeling. But so many people have lost the art. It's because we spend so much time in our virtual realms that we're not sensitive to people anymore. But if you learn to develop this muscle, which I describe in detail how you can, it's immensely powerful. It almost gives you the ability to read other people and understand not what they're thinking, but what they're feeling. And I maintain that we have this illusion that we're basically these rational thinking animals. And in my books, I say that we're basically emotional animals. Most of what motivates our behavior are just raw, basic emotions. And so empathy is the ability to kind of make yourself sensitive to what other people are thinking and feeling.
If you understood the laws of human nature, either as the individual or as the person looking at that other person, can that help in relationships, jobs, and everything else?
Oh, it would help immensely. So, on the one hand, I mean, you're going around in the world and you don't really understand the people that you're dealing with. I think, if I just pulled a number out there, I would say that you see about 5% of who the person is that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, your colleagues, and even to some extent your intimate partners. Obviously, it's going to be more than 5% with a spouse
that you
lived with for many years, but it's still surprisingly how little you really understand them. And so when you operate in the dark like that, you're going to make all kinds of mistakes. You're going to underestimate and overestimate certain people's skills or abilities. You're not going to understand why they're reacting the way they're reacting to you. And so it's extremely important as a social animal who depends on how you work with other people around you and how you communicate with your children, your family, your colleagues, your boss, to be able to pick up these signals that I describe in my books.
And let me ask you, Robert, too, the motivations of some of these individuals who, you know, a lot of people gear success based on performance and money. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but it's easy to judge when you look at the Elon Musks, the Jeff Bezos, the Bill Gates. They're successful people. And they made a lot of money doing what they do. If you were to analyze every one of them, what would you say they all generally have?
Well, that's what I talk about in the 48 Laws of Power. They are much more ruthless than you think they are. They
really?
Yeah. Bill Gates is an insanely competitive individual. He hates losing. I mean, I know this personally when I was in the 90s when I was writing about his battle with Netscape, if we can all remember back that far. And he was incredibly strategic and incredibly cutthroat. I mean, you don't create a business like Microsoft without having that kind of mentality. You know, I'm a great believer in what Machiavelli called effective truth. And effective truth means you don't look at what people say or the image they try to present. You look at their actions. You judge them on their actions, and that will tell you who their character is. So if you look at what Jeff Bezos has created, it's like the most insanely powerful monopolistic company that has probably ever existed on our planet. And I say that it's kind of ironic for me to say that because so much of my income depends on Amazon, where the sales of my books are. So I hope he's not listening into this right now.
He just might be.
But these people are much more competitive and much more ruthless than you think they are. And Elon Musk, you know, he's a very interesting character. Some people have said he's kind of a raging narcissist.
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're at a break. We'll come back and pick it up right there. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Green with us. We're talking about his latest work called The Laws of Human Nature. We'll talk about some of his other works as well tonight. We'll be taking calls with Robert next hour, so get ready for that. Robert, Leo DeRocher, when he was the manager for the Brooklyn Dodgers, once said, "Last nice guys finish last." Is that true?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. So a lot of the people that we're talking about, they're much more, as I said, they're kind of ruthless. And if I say that there's one personality profile that they would share, is they do tend to be somewhat narcissistic. I mean, if you're the CEO of a very large company like that, and it's very complicated, and you're dealing with thousands upon thousands of people, you have to be pretty tough, pretty hard-nosed. I worked on the board of directors of a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange for several years. And I saw firsthand the CEO of a company, and he could be very, very ruthless, very competitive. He wasn't a nice guy by any means. He had a charming side, and a lot of people who have kind of a narcissistic personality disorder, they can be very charming. They understand that that's important, and they know how to appear to be interested in other people. But I would say that generally, those who rise to the top and who are the top of in various different fields, particularly in Hollywood, where I worked for many years, they're not necessarily the nicest people in the world. But of course, there are some exceptions. You can't completely generalize on that.
I think you're right. I've been getting to when I meet some CEOs from companies, in a lot of different companies, they all tend to have those similar traits of their, kind of abrasive. But the underlying people, their vice presidents, seem to be nice people.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said for certain leaders who are able to play the soft game and can be very kind of seductive in their way and have a kind of common touch. I think, that's sort of what made a Lincoln a great president and some other presidents who seem to have that sort of common touch to them. They can relate to the average person. That can be a very, very powerful quality. But I know in my own experience that sometimes you have to be able to fire people. You have to be able to set boundaries. If people aren't performing well, you just have to let them go. And, in my war book, I studied some of the greatest generals in history, and certainly generals and people in the military, they can't get very far being very nice.
I was just a kid during the Kennedy era, so obviously I didn't know about his philandering and his personal life, but he appeared to be a great president for a youngster. Was the perception right or not?
Well, the consensus on Kennedy is very mixed. So some people think he was a great president. Some people think he was quite a terrible president. I think, there's some things about him that are admirable. And I've done consulting with politicians before, people who look to me to help them with their campaigns. And I always point to the 1960 campaign against Nixon. And he did some very brilliant things. So his whole idea of the new frontier, the problem with America in running the United States is we're such a diverse country. And, we don't have a defined identity like a France or an England. And so a president who can find a vision that kind of unifies us and brings us all together and creates a kind of an ideal and says, this is what it means to be an American, this is what the future is going to be like, has a very, very powerful message. And that was the brilliance of Kennedy's 1960 campaign, where he kind of talked about the new frontier, where as opposed to the pioneers of the 19th century, our new frontier is going to be outer space and starting the putting a man on the moon. And so that kind of visionary side of Kennedy was brilliant. But then in other ways, he wasn't very good sometimes with the day-to-day, running the day-to-day affairs. He didn't have a lot of experience. He only had like 8 years in the Senate, and so unlike someone like a Johnson, who I don't think was necessarily a great president either, Kennedy, I don't think, was a seasoned politician. He was really good at the public relations side. So I think there was something very exciting about his youth and the image he presented, which was completely false. You know, he presented this kind of vigor of a guy playing football on the lawn, and I'm you know, old enough to remember that. But in fact, he had a lot of physical defects. He had terrible condition with his back and other ailments. So a lot of it was kind of an illusion that he created. More than anything, he was a public relations master, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. And his father had a lot to do with that, too.
His father was incredible. He was the real Machiavellian. He was the real kind of man behind the throne, yeah. He was very, very clever.
And what really propelled Kennedy was that televised debate with Nixon, where Kennedy looked fresh and tanned and relaxed. And Nixon had his 5-hour shadow on his beard, and he looked horrible.
Yeah, well, the thing about people don't realize about Kennedy was that he was obsessed with Hollywood. He was really loved watching movies, and his favorite actor was Montgomery Clift, and his favorite movie was a movie, Red River. I think it was a Howard Hawks movie. And he studied Hollywood actors. He studied how they stood before the camera, how they could portray, how they could kind of give off a certain charisma, a calmness about them. And he spent hours studying them. And so he was the first president who was brilliant with television. But that didn't just come naturally. He studied it, and he was sort of obsessed with kind of, and his father was very active in Hollywood, so he knew a lot of the actors as well.
Before you started to sit down and outline the laws of human nature, tell me what you were thinking about when you were beginning to put the book together.
Well, you know, I receive a lot of emails from people over the years from the books that I write. And I had a book prior to the Human Nature called Mastery, in which I try and describe the process it takes to become really, really great at your field, to become a true master, very creative. And I had a chapter in there about social intelligence. And the idea was, I don't care what field you're in, if you don't understand people, all the skill and talent in the world won't do you any good. You'll constantly be butting up against your own mistakes. You'll do foolish things. And if you don't know how to work with people, you know, all your skill will just be neutralized. And people wrote to me saying, you know, Robert, that really resonated with me, but I need a lot more. And I got this feeling through those emails and also through the consulting work that I do with CEOs that something is happening in the world in the last, 20, 30 years, where a lot of the skills that we used to possess, social skills, in which we were able to understand people and kind of communicate with them and kind of be able to understand what motivates people, these skills are being degraded in our world slowly, I think because of technology, where we're not spending as much time with other people in social situations. And because of that, we're losing that skill. And so the point of the laws of human nature is to kind of help you reverse that. I'm giving you a code book, sort of the Rosetta Stone, for deciphering what's really going on behind people's masks. Because, you know, people don't really ever tell you exactly what they're feeling. Even your spouse will often, you know, compliment your looks when he or she doesn't really mean it. It's very hard to know exactly what people think about you, what is really going on behind the smiles that they wear. And so I wanted to show you in my book kind of how to look deep inside not only other people but yourself as well and kind of decode the sources of what's really going on behind all of kind of the social politeness that we have in our culture.
Robert, you're at a party and a lady walks in or a guy walks in with a god-awful suit or she has a horrible-looking dress, but you go up to her and say, oh, you look great in that outfit. It looks so great on you, or that's a great-looking suit. So it's a lie, but you make them feel good. Is there anything wrong with that?
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I practice that all the time because there's no point in going up and making people feel bad. I mean, what are you going to get out of that? They're going to feel terrible, and in the end, you know, whenever I find myself situations where I've been honest or I've complained or yelled at somebody, I often feel worse for myself the next day. But when I make people feel better about themselves, when I make them feel like They're the star of the show, and what they said, I think, is intelligent. You know, they open up to you, and they, you know, in the world today, people don't get enough recognition and validation, and we're all sort of starving for that. So if you're the person who goes up to people and makes them feel better about themselves, even if it's a bit of a white lie, I'm all in favor of that, because I think it's a very important part of being a social animal.
Did you look at the dark side of people?
Very much so. So I have a chapter on what I call the shadow side of the human personality. And everybody has a shadow. It's like the dark side of the moon. It's the side that we hide from other people. And I discuss in that chapter the origins of our dark side of that shadow, how when we were children, we would say or do things, you know, whatever we felt. We could be extremely polite, but then behind our parents' back, we would pull our sister's hair.
Eddie Haskell and Leave It to Beaver, remember him?
Oh, believe me, my older sister, she could tell you tales as well, yeah. And so we didn't have as much self-control, and we could be very nice and could be very aggressive and devilish, you know, Dennis the Menace side type thing. And then as we get older, a lot of that gets punched out of us. We have to be so nice and accommodating. We have to please people. We have to fit into the group. And all of those qualities that are actually a part of us, aggressive impulses, impulses where we don't necessarily want to be so nice to others, they get kind of pushed down inside, that we repress them, and then they come out later in life. And I always tell people, when you see like political figures in the news who are caught with their pants down literally in some affair in a hotel or something that, and the first thing they say is, I don't know what came over me. That isn't me. That isn't really who I am. And I tell people that is exactly who they are.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's exactly what they've been trying to hide, and it came out in a moment where they couldn't control themselves. So people's dark side will tend to come out later in life in behavior that suddenly seems to go against their character because they've been trying for so many years to tamp it down, and it just kind of sneaks out against their will. So I want to make you aware of your own dark side and how it operates in other people all the time.
Are we born with this dark side, or is it developed?
I think we're born with it. So, I mean, if you've been around children or if you've had children, you know from a very early age that they have behavior that we later would classify as a bit antisocial, that they would not engage in if they were like 20 or 30 years old in the work world. And slowly they learn to be socialized and polite. And in doing that, you also lose a lot of who you are. You lose a lot of your own authenticity, a lot of your own powerful creative energy. So I think that everyone is kind of born with it to some degree. And some people don't really disguise it very much as they get older. They kind of revel in their dark side. And that's not so good either. So most of us learn very early on to kind of hide it. But I want to show you, like, for instance, you know, I look at a lot of athletes who I think have a very pronounced dark side, and it comes out in their intense competitive nature.
Mm-hmm.
And they use their dark side to become successful, like a Kobe Bryant, for instance, or a Tiger Woods. Now, of course, you know, Tiger Woods, it got him in a lot of trouble. There were other problems there as well.
Right.
But that kind of energy, you know, or great artists and filmmakers who learn how to kind of express the dark side that, you know, we live in such a politically correct world where people are so afraid to really say and do what they feel. I know I sound like I'm contradicting myself when I was telling people to compliment them, but I also believe that there's space for us to kind of be able to be not so politically correct and not so worried about everything we say and do. And so, you know, that kind of dark energy, when a great filmmaker or artist or musician kind of expresses some of those darker impulses that we all have, we go, fantastic. Wow, you know, that's really wonderful. You're venting. You're kind of expressing what I feel. I wish I could feel or express, but I don't have the guts to. So using your dark side also has value, and I talk about that in my book.
Robert, what is a psychopath?
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I can't clinically define for you a psychopath. I'm no more like a sociopath, where these are people with very, very antisocial tendencies who have not learned, who are so controlling, and who look at other people as basically tools for themselves, as instruments for their own power. And they tend to be like very high on the narcissistic personality disorder scale. Psychopaths get into, you know, serial killers and murderers like that. And that's a little bit outside my scope here.
All right. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to take a quick break and come back a little bit later in a moment and take some phone calls with you. Robert Greene with us. His latest book is called The Laws of Human Nature. I do want to get into some of his other works as well, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. Fascinating discussion. Let's take your calls when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast.